The America's Democrats podcast, a project of 21st Century Democrats, is made possible by contributions from our listeners. Want to do more? Go to americasdemocrats.org and click donate. And thank you for allowing us to be your voice. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends on Facebook and Twitter and leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. This is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. I'm your host, Jim Cuddy. This week, what will it take to bring unions back and help workers stand up for their rights? Plus, what working-class voters want and what that means for 2020. And Bill Press talks with Ruth Marcus about her book, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Had enough of Fox News, the House Freedom Caucus, and Donald Trump? If you want the facts that you won't get from them or from the fake news sites of the alt-right, then stay tuned. Our sponsor, 21st Century Democrats, works hard to get everyday Democrats involved in returning our party to its roots and to success at the ballot box. Sit back and listen, then stand up and fight. And follow 21st Century Democrats on Facebook for all the latest progressive news. We're glad you can join us. After decades of corporate union busting, author Sean Richman says, never have so many workers needed so much support. His new book offers an action plan to bring the power of unions back to workplaces across America. And we say hello to Sean Richman, who is an In These Times contributing writer and the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at State University of New York, or SUNY, Empire State College. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean Richman, thanks very much for joining us today on the America's Democrats podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure to speak with you. We want to start by talking about why this book even had to be written. You write that never have so many workers needed so much support. Give us your snapshot of the state of working America today.
Well, I mean, we've got tremendous economic inequality a tremendous lack of power for workers on the job. So you see that expressed in everything from mandatory arbitration agreements signed as a condition of employment, non-compete agreements also as a condition of employment for sandwich artists at Jimmy John's sandwich restaurants. And we see it with sort of rising healthcare premiums and the cost of health insurance, and this sort of tremendous monopsony power of employers that even in a time of low unemployment, official low unemployment, the employers are able to really dictate the terms of employment, and we're going backwards in terms of our living standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Jimmy John's one is just sort of head scratching to me. It's like, really?
They did it because there's no unions in that sector of the economy, and there's no unions in many sectors of the economy at this point. And so the reason I wrote this book is, you know, look, there have been a lot of very good books written about why we need to bring unions back. And you could open up, you know, the New York Times Sunday Review any given week, and there'll be an argument for why we got to bring unions back. And I'm saying that that's actually more complicated than it sounds. And that unions are very complicated organizations. They're complicated by law. They're complicated by internal democracy and strategic considerations. They're complicated by history. We have to sort of break down what a union is into its constituent parts, and so we can evaluate what works, what do we want to revive, and what needs to be changed.
Well, and I want to touch more on that in a moment, but let's talk about the role of corporations. I mean, as you look at the role of corporations in getting us to this place, how do you understand their strategy? Is it a war being won battle by battle, or do you actually see corporations acting in a more coordinated and long-range framework?
It's been a very coordinated and long-range framework, and it really goes back to the Taft-Hartley Act and the days after the Taft-Hartley Act. I mean, you basically had a segment of corporate America that never accepted the New Deal, that never accepted labor law and workers' rights enshrined in the law. It was a minority group at first, but this is a group that sort of coalesced around the Chamber of Commerce, coalesced around the group that eventually formed up at George Mason University. This is a group that eventually coalesces around the Koch brothers. And so what had been sort of a fringe movement, or what looked like a fringe movement in the 1950s, really became the very mainstream and across the board strategies of union avoidance in the late 1960s, in the 1970s. We think of, you know, Reagan firing the air traffic controllers as when it starts, but actually the war on workers was being won already in the 1970s when you know, unions were doing everything they had to do in terms of new organizing. They were organizing in the workplaces they needed to, in the South, in workplaces that had, you know, a lot of women workers and workers of color. The number of organizing campaigns, the number of union elections that were being scheduled, continued to climb into the 1970s. The win rate was going down because the employers realized that there were no repercussions for breaking the law, and so the strategy became just break the law.
Well, without blaming the victim too much, we do have to acknowledge the role of unions in their own decline. What have been some of the biggest mistakes in recent years?
I think that we need to sort of step back and look at the overall strategy and the framework. And I think that there's been too much fidelity to a framework that bases whether you have a union or not on the specific workplace that you work in, and whether a group of workers voted for a union sometime in the past and managed to hold on to the union. That sort of workplace-based exclusive representation framework is really what the employers have seceded from. And that's why you have the rise of sort of independent contracting. That's why you have subcontractors of subcontractors of subcontractors. That's why you have all this offshoring. It's all meant to avoid and evade where a union is, because a union is based on, you know, your specific workplace. And so I think that we've spun our wheels a lot and too much in terms of trying to reform the National Labor Relations Act, instead of looking at sort of all-in systems of union representation and how do we make having a union in every workplace the legal default, which does require sort of breaking up the framework a little bit.
Well, Sean, let's talk about how workers can reclaim their power. I mean, how much of this lands on unions perhaps doing something different?
There are definitely changes that are within our power to make, and I lay some of those out in the book. And some of these are things that official unions can do. So, for instance, I think as you see more workplaces go, quote unquote, right to work, like the entire public sector has gone, where everybody is represented by the union, but joining the union is voluntary. You see a lot of unions currently, I think, sort of trying to get everyone they can to join the union, just to keep the revenue coming in. And I suggest that actually what we should be doing is focusing on leaders first. Because in a framework where not everybody is a union member and people opt in, your members wind up being your de facto representatives. And so if the first person to rush and join the union is a sexist, is a lazy worker, is a racist, you're alienating all of your potential members. And so being more strategic about who you recruit to membership first is a change that is within unions' power to make. But unions are very limited in terms of what we can do, because the law while there are no repercussions for employers that break the law, there are very severe repercussions for unions that break the law. They outlawed solidarity, taking a dispute to an employer that is not the direct employer of the workers, but does significant business with them, is illegal. So supermarkets, you know, when Oreo, you know, shipped their jobs out of Chicago and sent them to Mexico, it would be completely illegal for United Food and Commercial Workers, for unionized workers in supermarkets, to say, well, we're not going to put Oreos on the shelves. We're just not going to touch, you know, a scab product. If they did that, there'd be triple financial damages for whatever Nabisco would claim would be their losses. That would bankrupt the union. So what I'm also suggesting in this book is that some of the changes that are within workers' power need to be done in sort of alternative worker organization models, and that we should take advantage of the fact that, you know, we have, you know, thousands of these sort of socialist activists that have gotten organized, you know, since the Trump election, and that what they should be doing is thinking about the workplaces where there are no unions. Where no union is seriously organizing, because the framework it makes it largely impossible, and be thinking about creative organizing tactics in those workplaces, things that would be illegal, but you have no treasury, so they can't come after your treasury if you're just a group of workers who decided to launch some sort of boycott and put it out on Twitter and GoFundMe and see who salutes the call.
We're speaking to Sean Richman, an In These Times contributing writer, program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College, and author of the forthcoming book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. So these groups getting together, they're trying to rebuild. You know, workers often turn to their lawmakers and the courts to defend their rights. What has been the pattern in recent years, though, in terms of government being willing or even able to support workers?
Well, so, you know, the law is essential. You know, there are some people on the left who have this sort of false bravado notion of, you know, only worker power gets it. And the fact is, you just don't have durable unions without some legal protections. We didn't really have durable unions until, you know, World War I, when the federal government started actively protecting some unions just to keep the production rolling during the war. In recent years, you see two trends going in opposite directions. The courts are incredibly hostile to unions, and that's because the right wing has been very effective in packing the courts with very ideological judges who are basically toddlers, so they're going to, you know, live in the court for 70 years, and that they will find any excuse to restrain the legal rights of unions and of workers, even if it flies in the face of other case law. You know, the recent really bad Supreme Court decisions are based in nothing at all. Just it's just made up whole cloth, because the legal rationale might have well been, screw you, we have the votes. I'm talking about the Janus decision and the Epic Systems decision, the mandatory arbitration. But on the other hand, the very encouraging thing is that at least within the Democratic Party, you are seeing more and more elected officials and aspiring elected officials who have recognized that the attacks on unions have directly impacted the Democratic Party's ability to gain office and maintain office. The Democrats have very slowly come around to the thing that Republicans realized a long time ago, that unions help Democrats win elections, and so you see it, you know, playing out in the Democratic primary, where every candidate has had to put out a labor platform, and some of them have been incredibly robust. I'm sort of kicking myself that I couldn't get this book published sooner, because I put a bunch of stuff in there. I thought, oh, this is crazy radical stuff, and it's all in Bernie's platform, it's all in Warren's platform. A lot of it turned up in Beto O'Rourke's platform, to my great surprise. So there's a recognition of we got to do something for workers fast, and we got to bring unions back fast, because even if the Democrats win in 2020, you got a midterm election coming around right away, and if you can't restore some degree of union membership fast, the Republicans, you know, they have their playbook of how, you know, voter suppression and, you know, to win their elections, and that's the playbook at this point.
Maybe Bernie and company read your notes or something ahead of time. I mean, it sounded like you were ahead of the curve, and all of a sudden there they are out with the same platform. And speaking of that, the 2020 election is often framed as one that requires any Democratic candidate to win over workers if that candidate wants to win the election. But what should workers be demanding from the Democratic contenders?
what workers should be demanding or what unions should be demanding, because those are, to a certain extent, separate questions. What unions should be demanding, I think that the Service Employees International Union has done the best job of playing these candidates off of each other and of placing a very firm demand of we want unions for all. What is your plan to put a union in every workplace in America? And it's because of that effort that they didn't rush to endorse anybody, and they're very clear, you know, we're on the issues here, and that is the ask. We're not going to settle for minor tweaks like card check. We want a union in every workplace in America. What's your plan? And you can see how many of the candidates have responded to that. For workers, you got to put money in people's pockets. it's very simple. You got to promise to raise the minimum wage and then do it right away. You got to fix healthcare so that people aren't paying more for less. You got to give working people some substantial protections on the job from capricious and arbitrary behaviors by employers. So, you know, whether that's fair scheduling laws, whether that is a just cause right to your job, all of those sorts of things. But you got to make substantial improvements in people's material conditions before the next election comes up. It's as simple as that. And if you do that, you know, I think voters are going to have some loyalty to you. If you just make a bunch of promises and don't deliver, you've got a problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Your book, speaking of promises to take on sacred cows. What are they?
Exclusive representation, for starters. I think that as a movement, we need to have a very serious conversation about what we gain from exclusive representation and what the employer gains from exclusive representation. Because it's a framework that, you know, is also in the employer's interest, because it is the pathway to delivering labor peace, periods of labor peace, a 3-year contract, a 5-year contract, whatever, where you can guarantee there's not going to be any strike, there's not going to be any slowdowns or anything like that. That's only enforceable under the terms of exclusive representation. And so I argue, you know, and I lay out some scenarios of what it would look like to break that framework and make employers regret what they've done with the Janus decision and with other sorts of union attacks. But also, again, in terms of legal reform, unions have this fidelity to exclusive representation, and I'm not sure that you can put a union in every workplace while maintaining fidelity to exclusive representation. Think of it this way. Every workplace has a government, right? We don't tend to think of it that way. We think of the government as the government, and that we have elections in November and the state house and whatever. But every workplace is a government. Most non-union workplaces are a dictatorship. A union turns it into sort of a constitutional monarchy. The boss is still the boss, but they have to bargain some things over with you. But a union election, an NLRB certification election, is the right wing likes to analogize these things as sort of a congressional election. You know, you're choosing your representatives, and that's why, you know, in card check they were like, oh, the sanctity of the secret ballot, how dare you, blah blah blah. But it's not like a congressional election. It's like an election to have a Congress in the first place. And that should not be the case. Whether there is going to be democracy in the workplace should not be on the ballot. The only question should be who your representative is. So in order to have, you know, unions for all, or an all-in system of representation, or day one union, where the question of whether there's going to be representation or not is not on the ballot, you do need to divorce the question of the government from the party, which is the union. In the book, I lay out a couple of thoughts about, you know, looking at sort of historical models and international models. You know, you could look to Germany and the Works Council model, where the Works Council is the government. It just exists. It is the framework for representation, for bargaining, for adjusting of grievances. And unions operate within that framework on a sort of voluntary basis where, you know, you join a particular union. There might be multiple unions that are contesting for power in your workplace. But regardless, the Works Council is there regardless of whether anybody joins the union or not. Another framework is wage boards, which is something that They both have different models, but again, it's in Bernie and in Warren's platform as a sort of a wage board model where you get sort of this you know, on an industrial basis, you take an entire sector of the economy, let's say fast food, and you have a board that there's some sort of worker representative, there's some sort of employer representative, there's some sort of public representative, where that board could set a rule that then has to apply to all workplaces in that sector of the economy. So a wage increase is an obvious one, but you could also set a rule that says in retail, there's going to be no clope-ins, which is when a worker is scheduled to open in the AM shift after having been scheduled to close the night before. So it's like you got to leave work for 4 hours and you're back the next day. So that's not going to be a practice all over. That would be a system of governance where that rule gets applied everywhere. Who is the worker representative at this sort of national or regional board? I don't know. Within the worker represent, within the workplaces themselves, in a model like that, you're probably not going to see one union only representing the workers. I think you're going to see unions competing, and competing over what kind of demands they can place before that wage board, and what kind of organizing activity and protest activity they can get going at specific workplaces where they've got an analysis of this employer is actually going to be the real decision maker at that wage board. This is a very different way of doing things compared to how unions are sort of legally structured in America currently. But it's also it's a model that is much more common in the rest of the world, where unionization rates are higher, and where there is a higher degree of union power, because it's a framework that makes it much harder for employers to evade the system and secede from the system.
And in turn, you have employees who feel protected. They feel like they're properly paid, and therefore productivity should in turn rise and be better. You've got people that look forward to coming to work as opposed to having to drag themselves into work. I mean, there's that side of it, too, that I don't think is ever addressed. But I think you touch on it here.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like making an argument for an employer about how unions improve the workplace. I mean, they don't care. I mean, unions do really improve the workplace. They actually improve productivity. Employee satisfaction is important, and unions do help as a release valve for when employees get disgruntled about employer decisions. But that role is not appreciated by unions. And again, back to sacred cows, that is one of the arguments that I make about why we should think about breaking the exclusive representation model. Because if you don't have exclusive representation, if you do have various unions in a single workplace vying for worker power, it means that whatever decision an employer gets made, they'll never have peace. Even if they made a deal with one union, there's another union that's going to crap all over that deal and say it's not good enough, and we should we should be going on strike, we should be picketing, whatever. I think that a part of the pathway forward here is making employers regret breaking up a system that did actually work in their interests when it worked well in the 1950s and 60s.
Absolutely. Sean Richman, the author of the forthcoming book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, joining us today on the America's Democrats podcast. Sean, really appreciate your time with us today and look forward to having you back again with us soon.
All right. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. And this is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. We want you to sit back and listen to this AmericasDemocrats.org podcast, a project of 21st Century Democrats. But we need you to stand up and fight. Do you want to get involved and help get our party back to its roots and to success at the ballot box? You can make your contribution to help us keep this show going and to elect Democrats who will stand up for democratic principles. Go to AmericasDemocrats.org and click on Donate at the top of the page.
Security measure.
I believe that we must pass legislation to provide medical care
This is our tradition. When our grandparents came to America, it was the Democratic Party which said, welcome. It was the Democratic Party, the party of Roosevelt and Truman and Kennedy and others, who said that America belonged to all its people, not just a handful of the rich or a few giant corporations. That's why great leaders like FDR fought so hard for Social Security, and why JFK stood up to the insurance companies and their Republican allies to get Medicare. It's not just one thing, or one time, in one place. It's about a whole history of standing up to the Republicans and saying someone has to be on the side of regular working people in America. Whether it's defending Social Security or just the way your loved ones are treated on the job. That's what the Democratic Party is all about. And that's why this message has been brought to you by the Democratic Party. Working people like you and me.
Paid for by 21st Century Democrats. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. This is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. Coming up next, how progressives can win working-class voters. It begins with asking them what they care about. But first, we turn to Jim Hightower, America's number one populist, for his common sense commentary.
Last year, Donald Trump said something stupid. Okay, nothing astonishing about that, but this stupid thing did astonish an entire nation, specifically Britain. Apparently, Trump had seen a Fox News report showing people over there protesting about their government-supported National Health Service. See, Trump tweeted excitedly, even the Brits are fed up with the idea of health care for all, rejecting a socialized system that, he sneered, is going broke and not working. But oops, the protesters were actually demonstrating in favor of their health service, demanding that the Tory government put, quote, more staff, more beds, more funds into the public program. Contrary to Trump's ignorance and class hatred of social programs, the British people love their tax-paid system, specifically because it does work. Everyone there is covered, getting quality care regardless of their income levels. And they don't have to fear that they'll be denied service or bankrupted by a rip-off medical system run by and for private insurance giants, hospital monopolies, big pharma, and other profiteers. To see a system that's really going broke and not working, the president could look at the 44 million Americans, including 4 million children, who have no health coverage, or at millions of others who are being gouged by ruthless drug makers, denied treatment by insurance bureaucrats, and drowned in debt by surprise medical bills. This is Jim Hightower saying, the problem with America's health care system is, hello, the system. During the past 30, 40 years, its structure has been wholly corporatized, perverting health care from a human right to just another commodity for sale. Its fundamental flaw is that the corporate purpose is not to maximize health for the many, but to maximize profits for the few. The system itself has got to be changed.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
This is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. Matt Morrison has worked on over 500 political campaigns. He now focuses on voter turnout for candidates who support a fair economy for working-class Americans. He says progressive Democrats can win over working-class voters if they're willing to show up and listen. And we say hello to Matt Morrison, Executive Director of Working America, a 3.5 million member labor organization mobilizing working people who don't have the benefit of a union at their jobs. Matt Morrison, thanks very much for joining us today on the America's Democrats podcast.
Jim, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
And our pleasure to have you with us. Matt, your organization recently published the results of a survey of working class voters to find out what they care about and what that means for the 2020 election. In terms of issues, what are the top concerns for these voters?
Well, you know, Jim, we've all heard this story again and again. Healthcare defines how voters are interpreting the election and the electoral environment. Certainly that was the case in 2018, and it continues today. But in a way, healthcare is a proxy for how people feel about their economic prospects. Do they feel like they have needs, adequate needs, adequacy in educational investment? Do they have adequate retirement savings? Do they have the ability to afford and access healthcare that they themselves need or that their families need, so that they feel a sense of security? That animates whether or not someone is inclined towards progressive candidates, whereas those who focus more on their fears, that is, are immigrants invading our country, is the government being taken over by people who are not like me, et cetera, animates whether or not folks are more inclined towards conservative candidates.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk solutions. And focusing on the economy, what types of policies are these voters likely to support?
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about especially the Democratic nominating contest. Are the policies going too far left? Are they likely to alienate voters needed to prevail? What we tend to find, and we talk to a lot of those voters who sit firmly in the middle in the battleground states, what are they looking for? What do they care about most? And what they care about isn't, is it too far left or too far right, but does it actually serve people's interests like my own? There's this one woman we were canvassing not long ago, Gertrude, in Central Ohio. She told us about her well-being, about her life conditions. And we asked her, well, did you know that the president's budget proposal eliminated low-income heating assistance funding, which a lot of people here in Central Ohio depend on to make sure that they can pay their heating oil bills in the winter? And not only did she not know, but you could see her physically collapse back into the sofa as she understood what this meant for her and said, that's not what he promised. So when we talk about the types of policy solutions people want, this isn't some academic question of do we have a supply side economy? It is, do I have an adequate supply of heating oil?
I mean, we're just talking about life's basics, and somebody has to worry about that to that extent, especially when they think everything's going to be okay.
That's exactly right. You get down to someone's eye-to-eye level and you talk to them by listening to them first rather than at them, which is often the case with so much of politics, and you'll get some amazingly obvious results.
Mm-hmm. Now, back in May, you said on a podcast that if nothing changed, Donald Trump would likely be reelected. Now, that was 6 months ago. What were you hearing then from working class voters that led you to that conclusion? And do you still feel that way?
You know, unfortunately, when I made that observation, we were seeing a lot of indicators. It wasn't just what we're hearing from the doors, although certainly that was part of it. But we also were seeing long-term trends in partisan behavior, indicators like Donald Trump's almost immovable approval ratings, especially in the battleground states, understanding the demography and economy that shapes the life outcomes for millions of people in the places that are going to make the biggest difference. And what we saw then was that while the economy has certainly improved, we have not made up the type of losses that working people have suffered for the last 45 years in this country, that people are no more confident in their ability to access and afford health care for their family than they were several years ago, and that you have this series of indicators. And so if you have a candidate slash incumbent who is very good at turning up the fear knob, and Democrats have struggled to be heard in a really congested and noisy political environment so that the need and hope knob can be turned up for so many of these voters, then that portended an awfully long road. What I think we've seen is that when we show up, we do win. You know, we were active in the Kentucky gubernatorial election, and one of the great pieces of work that we did was finding out in the last 2 weeks that if we took a message that we had tested at the doors through a series of clinical measures, talking about voters being one emergency room visit away from losing everything, and shared that message with a couple of 100,000 rural Kentucky voters in counties that had largely been trending red over the past couple of election cycles, we saw a huge change in voter behavior. And this isn't just a small change. We added, just from this one tactic, 7,901 extra votes for Andy Beshear, the Democratic nominee, in a race that he beat incumbent Governor Matt Bevin by 5,150 votes in. So you can change the outcome, but the fundamentals still suggest a razor close race despite all of everything that Donald Trump has done, and including what he hasn't yet been convicted of. And so we're talking about, how do voters actually understand the world around them? We have to start with understanding there's some pretty basic errors in how Democrats are prosecuting campaigns. In an environment where Donald Trump gets somewhat four times the amount of free media that Barack Obama got at the exact same point in his presidency, and Barack Obama was our country's first black president, that tells you just how lopsided the information systems are in favor of this type of conservative demagogue. We have to be prepared to break past those media filters, where television and cable news just aren't going to do the job to educate people. There are not local newspapers in Scranton, Pennsylvania anymore. We need to show up and make sure that there is a channel by which people can understand, what does it really mean when this latest trade deal is being negotiated? What does it really say that Mitch McConnell has allowed so many important pieces of legislation to languish on his desk? That's what we have to focus on, instead of investing untold millions of dollars in channels of communication that, quite frankly, have been shown not to move one single vote.
We're speaking with Matt Morrison, executive director of Working America, a 3.5 million member labor organization mobilizing working people who don't have the benefit of a union at their jobs. Matt, let's talk about what progressive Democrats need to do to win over the working class vote. Now, there is a school of thought among some Democrats that suggests a centrist candidate would be more electable than a more progressive candidate. What are your conversations with voters telling you about that question?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that diagnosis. If what we're banking on is allowing voters to make impressionistic decisions without examining any substantive issues and their place in our politics, then yeah, going for someone who looks affable enough, maybe that'll work, maybe it won't. We'll see. Certainly, Trump has gone the opposite direction, which is to galvanize his base and give a very clear contrast. And so when one side is being clear and the other is being ambiguous, you don't always get a bright line for voters to make a distinction on. I would say that the bigger problem here is what we're presupposing, that we're not actually going to compel voters to examine the choices they're making. Our approach to this is to show up at the front door, listen to them, have a conversation, ask them what's most important for you and your family to see change with the next president. We're compelling the person to process what they need rather than who they hate or who they've been told to hate or trust or distrust or fear. And in so doing, we're putting the power of government and governance in their hands. So, you know, this kind of centrist candidate stuff, some might call it mumbo jumbo. I just call it garbage. But
fair enough.
Yeah. But you see the dilemma there. It's mm-hmm. a question of what type of campaigns do we anticipate running?
Right. Well, and then there's another school of thought that suggests Democrats should focus on bringing in new voters of color rather than win back the traditional white working class voter. Is this a choice that has to be made?
You know, it's not only a choice that doesn't have to be made, but you can't make it. the set of concerns that alienated so many black voters in Wisconsin in such a way that 100,000 fewer of them participated are the exact same reasons that you had a couple of 100,000 rural voters in Wisconsin switch partisan allegiances between 2012 and 2016. That is, no one is listening to them. And this isn't theoretical. We've gone out and asked thousands of people in the last last 3 years, is there anyone in the system that you can name that's fighting for you? The number one response we get, no matter where we do it, what the race or place is, I can't name a single politician who's fighting for me. Mm. Now, but putting aside the morality of the question of, you know, can you win with just a base mobilization strategy or reaching out to white working class voters, which is a real moral framing. Questions, can you win with a working class agenda that resonates with those two communities, or do we continue to compromise towards a more corporatist agenda that further alienates people to be left on their own? And I think you know the answer to that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing, too,
one more Jim, I'm sorry, this may get picked up in editing. Just one more point on this. When you look at the math of it, and this is the thing that's really quite daunting, you can certainly improve electoral outcomes by focusing on one part or another of the strategy. But in a state like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, where a majority of the voters are white people without college degrees, it is political malpractice not to have a strategy that speaks to both your people of color urban base and white non-college voters. Otherwise, you're just ceding half of the field to the opposition before the game even starts.
Well, you know, something that you mentioned earlier, Matt, is you knock on doors, you ask people questions, and you listen to what they have to say. And that doesn't happen, especially on the national level in politics right now. And I think that's probably why we see a lot of different sections of our society get left out, because nobody's listening to them.
You said it.
Now, back in October, your organization, Working America, announced it was investing $70 million in working class voter engagement. What do you hope to accomplish with this investment?
Well, our work is focused on organizing people around the things that matter most to them, but also doing so in a measurably effective way. Our intention here is we will engage some 2 million Working America members through consistent and sustained digital education and engagement. So rather than hearing during the noisiest time of the year, elections, what the importance of a union card is in your economic well-being, what the best path for bringing down the cost of prescription medications are, or what a real health care system looks like instead of a sick care system looks like. We're educating people all year round to make sure they understand how the economy works and where they fit in it. And the second thing is we're going to visit people. We're going to visit the homes and have conversations with 3 million individuals and concentrated in 9 battleground states across the country. Those states include places like North Carolina, Arizona, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, but also Minnesota and Wisconsin, Iowa, and Georgia, as well as Ohio. And the goal there is not just to flip votes for an election. We will win an extra 500,000 voters for our candidates up and down the ballot. That's not in question. The goal is to create the type of long-term change so that a class of people more permanently become regular voters and a class of people become more regular progressive voters, changing the long-term political economy of those states.
And, you know, Matt, before we let you go, your work has been highly praised for its effectiveness in winning over swing voters. What are some of the signature elements of your strategy?
You know, my predecessor in the role, Karen Nussbaum, one of the founder of Working America, made this really thoughtful observation that I think we should just put on a T-shirt. Don't tell someone what they know is wrong. Tell them something they don't know. When you respect people and tell them that, you know, you can have an opinion and there's validity to the opinion, but will you also consider something else? They open up. They magically listen to you. That's evidenced by the 150 randomized clinical measures of our program that we've conducted over 560 elections. That's why our candidates have won 64% of those contests. That's why we're able to say with scientific certainty that of the 6.2 million people who are likely to vote in Pennsylvania next year, 2.4 million of them are open to being swayed to support our candidate. If we focus on just the million most persuadable of amongst that 2.4 million, then we will deliver an extra 130,000 voters for our candidates up and down the ballot. That's the value of really telling someone something they don't know and respecting them in the first place, but also combining it with clinical rigor.
Mm-hmm. And listening. You know, I mean, a couple different times in our conversation here today, you've talked about listening to what people have to say, listen to their issues that they're having at home. I mean, not having enough money to pay for your heat and thinking that wasn't going to be an issue next year, and now all of a sudden it is.
What did you say?
All right. So Matt Morrison, Executive Director of Working America, he really does listen. They all do listen, of course. 3.5 million member labor organization mobilizing working people who don't have the benefit of a union at their jobs. Matt joining us today on the America's Democrats podcast. Matt, we appreciate your time with us and look forward to hearing back from you again soon.
I'm sorry. Did you say something?
I tried. You weren't listening.
Next time. Thanks so much for having me on. Really a pleasure.
Thank you, Matt. We enjoyed it as well. And this is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. We want you to sit back and listen, but we need you to stand up and fight. Help get our party back to its roots and to success at the ballot box. Make your contribution to keep the AmericasDemocrats.org podcast, a project of 21st Century Democrats, on the air, and help elect stand-up Democrats. Go to AmericasDemocrats.org and click on Donate at the top of the page. This is the America's Democrats podcast, the weekly podcast for stand-up Democrats. And now the inside story of Brett Kavanaugh's ascent to the Supreme Court. Bill Press talks with Ruth Marcus, author of Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover.
Has Brett Kavanaugh proven to be as bad as some of us feared? What do you think?
Well, he has not proven to be as conservative as President Trump's first choice, Neil Gorsuch. We'll know a lot more this coming June than we do right now, because this is going to be the term that way more than last term is going to tell us about the shape of this court. It's not going to tell us whether or not it's a conservative court, because that's just not up for discussion. Mm-hmm. This is a conservative court. It's just a question of how conservative, how muscularly conservative, how eager this court is going to be to put some of those conservative views into practice, either stretching precedents or overturning precedents.
What are some of those big cases coming up in June that you're looking at?
Well, it's actually really amazing how many different types of cases there are. There's a big abortion case that's coming up. It's a fascinating case because it is almost identical to one that was decided 5-4 by the Supreme Court a few years ago with Justice Kennedy, who obviously Justice Kavanaugh replaced, providing the fifth vote. So if the fifth vote to overturn an abortion restriction. The court took this case, involves an almost identical statute, this one from Louisiana. If the court flips, that will tell us something about where this new court is heading. But wait, that's not all. Mm. There is a gun case at the court that they might dismiss because it's moot. But there is a case involving the scope of employment protections for gay, lesbian, and transgender workers. There's a case about DACA, the Dreamers program, and the court just on Friday took a set of cases that involve whether the president has to respond or his agents have to respond to subpoenas seeking his financial and tax records. So it is shaping up to be a potentially blockbuster term.
The perfect storm.
Yeah.
Right? So in the book, you talk about the fact that growing up, even through college, I believe. Kavanaugh had a reputation for being he has a drinking problem, but a nice guy, a guy who liked to get along with everybody, and everybody liked him, and he was into sports and everything, and a guy who getting people together and everything. And then he took a sharp turn to the right, maybe when he went to work with Ken Starr. Is it possible that he comes back to the old, I want everybody to like me, Kavanaugh?
Sure, because Justice Kavanaugh, and the best way to understand him perhaps is to compare and contrast him with Justice Kennedy, who obviously had a similarly difficult experience during his confirmation process. For Justice Kennedy, I think the experience of that confirmation process really pushed him even further to the right than he would have been otherwise. I think it embittered him. We could see the anger that he displayed there and afterwards in some of his personal writings in his autobiography. Justice Kavanaugh is a different type of person, and there is a he has always wanted to be – he's been conservative for quite a while, but as a conservative, he's also very much enjoyed being part of the legal establishment. He's a guy who enjoyed teaching at Harvard Law School and Yale Law School, wants to be accepted by that community,
right,
which much of which recoiled during his confirmation hearings. And so I think that though there's a possibility that he will simply pick that conservative team and be on it even more fiercely than he might have been otherwise, he's telling his friends that he wants to be the same justice he would have been had none of this happened. And I think that if you look at the cases from last term, you see him much closer to the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who, make no doubt, is a conservative justice, but he is a much less fiercely and aggressively conservative justice than Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch at that further end of the conservative spectrum.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the nomination process, the confirmation process, and the vote. And you go through all of those in great detail in the book. In terms of the nomination, you cannot call Brett Kavanaugh an accidental justice. You point out this was his goal, like, from the time he was in diapers, and he really worked hard at it in jobs that he took and moves that he made all the way through. Right?
I'm not sure about diapers, but certainly certainly from shortly after graduating from law school, he talked about his desire to become a judge. And he also talked reasonably openly about his desire to be on the Supreme Court someday. But it's interesting because he is, in a sense, an accidental justice. And I'm going to tell you this story pretty quickly. But Brett Kavanaugh was clerking in Delaware for a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, a perfectly mainstream Republican judge. And he was on his way to work at Williams & Connolly, which is a very prestigious and well-regarded law firm here in Washington, ironically the law firm that represented Bill and Hillary Clinton during the last impeachment and the Whitewater investigation.
That's Washington.
And it's a very small world. But one day, while he's clerking, Brett Kavanaugh, a year out of law school, gets a call from a Yale Law School professor who says a judge on the Ninth Circuit, a judge your listeners may have heard of named Alex Kaczynski, he later had to quit over his own sexual misconduct issues. Kaczynski has a sudden opening in his chambers. A guy named Alex Azar, who may sound familiar because he's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has suddenly quit after 6 weeks. Would you like to clerk for him? And Brett Kavanaugh takes less than 24 hours to consider this and says, heck yes, because Judge Kaczynski is a feeder judge. That helps him get his clerkship for Justice Kennedy, without which I don't think we would have Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court today. So in that sense, accidental.
And that's accidental. But again, he saw that as a stepping stone. He knew what he was doing. That got him to Kennedy as a clerk. Then he goes for Ken Starr. He ends up a little bit of private practice into the White House. He marries George Bush's secretary.
He does. And, you know, the book is called Supreme Ambition, not for one reason, but for two reasons. One is that it reflects this ambition of Justice Kavanaugh's that you've been discussing. It also reflects the ambition of the conservative movement after 30 difficult years to finally cement a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. But it's interesting that you mentioned President Bush, because he also played as with Justice Kennedy, a critical role in Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation. At the first part of it, he was the biggest albatross around then Judge Kavanaugh's neck. Brett Kavanaugh did not believe he was going to be selected for the job because he was such a Bushy, as you said, mm-hmm. not just nominated by him, not just worked for him, but literally married the president's secretary, who the Bushes viewed as an almost third daughter. But once he was, and that did not endear him, to put it mildly, to President Trump. But once he was nominated, President Trump called President Bush. Very rare for them to speak to each other, said, I picked your guy. And President Bush, as Justice Kennedy did earlier, went to bat for Brett Kavanaugh and made critical phone calls to senators to help him get across that finish line.
And at the final part of his campaign was, I guess, in that when the first list, Donald Trump promised, you give me a list, I will appoint somebody who's on that list. Brett Kavanaugh's name was not on the original list. But he didn't take no for an answer, right? With the help of some very people close to Trump.
Brett Kavanaugh's name was interestingly not on three lists during the campaign.
Three lists.
His name was not on the original list that Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society gave to Donald Trump, then candidate Trump, suggesting potential mm-hmm. nominees. He was not on the first list that candidate Trump issued in the May of the election year, and he was not on the second list that he issued in the fall of the election year. This didn't seem like it was a big deal when, as everybody well understood, Donald Trump was never going to be president. But it was a problem for Brett Kavanaugh and his ambitions when Donald Trump was elected. And he had a twofold problem. He had a Bush problem with President Trump mm-hmm. because he was a Bushy. And he had a conservative problem with Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society and some of the other conservatives who were worried in part because of a ruling in which then-Judge Kavanaugh failed to overturn the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. They were worried that he was not going to be conservative enough. And so that was a fascinating moment where a bunch of conservatives, particularly social conservatives, tried to take down then-Judge Kavanaugh as a nominee before he was ultimately selected.
Right. So he finally gets on the list. And then you talk about – and I think you're the first one to report this – that Justice Kennedy personally really got involved lobbying for the president directly, right?
Tell us
about that.
Well, as I said, Brett Kavanaugh had this problem. The president had promised to pick only from his list, and his name was not on it. And the White House at this time very much had its eye on Justice Kennedy as the most likely justice to depart. And President Trump loved the adulation he got picking Justice Gorsuch. It was really at a very rocky time in his presidency. When has there not been a rocky time in his presidency? This was his one of his crowning achievements, and he wanted the chance to do it again. And so when Justice Kennedy was at the White House in the spring of 2017 swearing in Justice Gorsuch, he asked for some time with the president. And during that meeting, which was not publicized, as you say, which I report for the first time in this book, he made the point, hey, you've got this list. There's a name missing from it. You might want to take a look at my clerk, Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh was Justice Kennedy's favorite clerk. And after that, President Trump started asking, hey, what about this guy Kavanaugh? Hey, how come nobody told me he went to Yale Law School and Yale College? Hey, how come nobody told me he worked for Ken Starr? He really liked the working for Ken Starr part because he liked somebody who had gone up against the Clintons. And lo and behold, within a few months after that meeting, the president issues a new and revised list, and it has the name of one Brett Kavanaugh on it.
So to borrow a phrase from today's news, was this a quid pro quo?
I think it's a much more subtle situation than that. But I think that it was absolutely clear that both President Trump and his White House counsel, Don McGahn, understood that Justice Kennedy was inclined to leave. Justice Kennedy was 80. He's a very loyal Republican. President Trump is not his kind of Republican, but he was not going to leave he wanted to be replaced by a Republican president, and this was the one that he had. And the Trump administration was going to do whatever it took to get Justice Kennedy comfortable with the notion of leaving, and that included getting Brett Kavanaugh onto that list. So explicit quid pro quo, I don't think so. Everybody understood what was going on here. Fairer presumption.
Even with Kennedy's role, it's also very clear that the Federalist Society really wields a lot of power when it comes to judicial nominations under a Republican president, right? It's almost a monopoly they've got. How did they get there?
Well, it's a fascinating story because the Federalist Society was formed in 1982 when we don't even remember the notion of looking at the Constitution through the lens of the original intent of the framers was looked at as a kind of wacky way to do constitutional interpretation. And legal conservatives were not particularly welcome or popular or abundant, to say the least, on law school campuses. Some of that may be true today. And so it was almost a kind of self-help support group that got created. But it turned into this incredibly powerful force in nurturing, in identifying, in growing, and then in vetting young conservative lawyers first to go into Republican administrations when a Republican president was in power, then to grow up on the lower federal courts, and then to be potentially plucked to be Supreme Court justices. That was true when Brett Kavanaugh and Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society worked together on judicial nominations during the George W. Bush administration, but it was increasingly true. It is increasingly true in this administration,
today,
in the Trump administration, because this president, particularly when he was still candidate Trump, was so distrusted by social conservatives, by evangelicals, that he did this thing that no president had done before in not just creating the shortlist, but making it public. That helped him get over the edge with conservatives. I don't think that Mitch McConnell doesn't think that he would have been elected president had it not been for that Scalia vacancy and for the development of the list.
And particularly with the evangelical community.
Especially.
That, right. Now, we get to the nomination process, and as we recall, it was only a year or so ago. Having gotten on the list and having been nominated, with the Republicans in control of the Senate, it may be a slam dunk is too hard of a word, but it looked like it was going to happen, right, until Christine Blasey Ford. How did her story come about? It wasn't easy, right?
Right. It was a very long story. Let me just say one sentence or two about the slam dunk situation. It was a 51-49 Senate. There was not a lot of leeway. And Don McGahn's argument for Brett Kavanaugh was that this was going to be the easy – I mean, this is ironic now, right? This was going to be the easiest one to get done. But Christine Blasey Ford – comes up. She tries desperately to reach her local congresswoman, Anna Eshoo, and then to reach her senator even before he is nominated. And they are a little bit slow in getting back to her. She has this story, but she also has this extraordinarily naive belief that if she just does what she called her civic duty and privately told senators what had happened, surely they wouldn't want to go forward with this. But that is not the Washington that we live in today, to say the least. And so she spent the whole summer just agonizing, and I describe her agonies in this book about whether or not to come forward, ultimately decides that she's not willing to come forward, and then that choice is taken from her.
Right. Because the letter that she had written to Dianne Feinstein leaked. Did Dianne Feinstein do the wrong thing by sitting on that letter, not turning it over to the chairman, not turning it over to other members of the committee?
I think she was in an exquisitely difficult position because if you have been the victim, or you say you have been the victim of a sexual assault, it should be your decision whether or not to come forward. And Dianne Feinstein was trying to be importantly respectful of Christine Blasey Ford's privacy in that situation, and also believed, as this was progressing, that Christine Blasey Ford would ultimately make the decision to come forward. But where I think Senator Feinstein really made a grievous error was in two ways. First, to not recognize it at the point when, even in July, late July, when Christine Blasey Ford finally reached her not to realize how many people she had already told about this. Christine Ford had told about it, and therefore how inevitable it was that something this explosive was going to come out. And second, Senator Feinstein took it on herself to make this decision about how to handle the letter. It's not just that she didn't go to Senator Grassley, then the chairman of the committee, because things are pretty poisonous here in Washington, and there are reasonable arguments against that. She didn't go to her own leadership and say, I have a problem here, but it's a problem that doesn't just affect me. It affects all of us. There are ex-Democratic senators right now who would very much like to wring Senator Feinstein's neck because they believe that her decision to about how to handle this really helped to cost them their seats.
Once Christine Blasey Ford came forward, did she get a fair shake? Did she get a fair shot to make her case?
Well, that's an interesting way to put the question, and I guess the answer is compared to what? I think in some ways she got a better, fairer, more respectful hearing than Anita Hill did, because I was sitting there during the Anita Hill hearings, and I have to say that all-male Judiciary Committee and the absolute failure of many of those senators to understand the realities of sexual harassment was a much worse circumstance than anything Christine Blasey Ford faced, and also the failure, honestly, of Democratic senators with Anita Hill to stand up for her. At the same time, I think more broadly, the FBI investigation was a colossal failure. Among the people it didn't, the FBI didn't interview are Christine Blasey Ford and Justice Kavanaugh. And one would think if you want to be, if you say there should be an FBI investigation, one obvious thing would be to interview. And yes, the committee interviewed her, but there is a difference between what senators can do and what the FBI can do.
You make that point that the FBI investigation was what, a week long, directed?
Less than that.
Less than that. Under total direction of the White House counsel, who said, here's who you can talk to, here's who you can't.
The White House did not want to have this FBI investigation. It only had the FBI investigation because the few Republican senators who were capable of holding it up because of that slim margin, Senator Flake, Senator Murkowski, Senator Collins, insisted on an FBI investigation. And just quite bluntly, this was not a hunt for the truth. It was a hunt for 50 votes. And the White House was going to interview only those people it was required to interview in order to get those 50 votes. And there were very important people that it left on the table.
So before we get to the votes, a couple of other people that come up. Deborah Ramirez, she didn't get a lot of attention, did she?
She did not. She was
similar accusation.
A similar accusation. Deborah Ramirez is a Yale classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's, and she recalled, and it was published in a story in The New Yorker right after the a week after the Christine Blasey Ford story erupted. She recalled an incident in which Brett Kavanaugh had essentially exposed himself to her in a party in a dorm room freshman year. She was interviewed, but there was another person named Max Steyer who recalled a similar incident involving a second woman, who I should say did not remember this incident herself. She was supposedly quite inebriated at the time, told friends that she didn't remember it happening. But Max Steyer, well-known person in town, runs a bipartisan think tank, did not want to come forward because he thought it would destroy his think tank, but tried desperately to get his information to the FBI, to get his information to Republican senators. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware tried to help him get his information to these Republican senators, and he was not interviewed. And his story, if correct, would have corroborated and supported Deborah Ramirez's story, which would have in turn supported and corroborated Christine Blasey Ford's story. You might think you'd want to know what he had to say, but that wasn't the interest, as I say. Nope.
And then finally, parachuting in from nowhere is Michael Avenatti. Yeah, with
yes,
this crazy
sigh.
Story about, yes, Julie Swetnick. No evidence behind it. Might have been true, but no evidence behind it. You say, either yourself or quoting someone in the book, if you want to blame anybody for Kavanaugh in the Supreme Court, blame Michael Avenatti.
Well, a guy named Mike Davis, who was a fascinating character. He's he was Chuck Grassley's chief nominations counsel. He mounted this rogue operation to deny Kavanaugh the nomination before he was nominated. But once he was nominated, became Kavanaugh's most fierce warrior. And he described, I think correctly, Michael Avenatti as manna from heaven. Because much as Steyer could have corroborated, I think when Michael Avenatti came in with a set of allegations from Julie Swetnick that were just rather outlandish and not credible on their face, that just had this trickle-down discrediting effect on the whole thing and really started to help turn the tables on the whole debate.
Bill Press talking with author Ruth Marcus. If you'd like to hear the entire interview, visit BillPressPods.com. And that's all for the America's Democrats podcast. Thank you to all who made today's show possible. Sean Richman, Matt Morrison, and the entire Bill Press team. And thank you for listening. If you liked what you heard, please get involved in our efforts to keep this show going and to elect Democrats who are bringing the party back to its roots. Go to AmericasDemocrats.org and click on Donate at the top of the page. And be sure to find 21st Century Democrats on Facebook and Twitter. And leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. For the America's Democrats podcast, I'm your host, Jim Cuddy. We want you to sit back and listen, but we need you to stand up and fight. Join us. Support the AmericasDemocrats.org podcast, a project of 21st Century Democrats, and help elect Democrats who will stand up for democratic principles with your contribution today. Go to AmericasDemocrats.org and click on Donate at the top of the page.